Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and my guest today is Andrea Bowman, author of Musical Solidarities, Political Action and Music in Late 20th Century Poland, published by Oxford University Press. In 1980, a group of Polish shipyard workers created a new trade union called Solidarity. Just 10 years later, one of its founders, Lech Walesa, was elected president of Poland. Bowman examines the music of dissension and protest during this turbulent decade in Polish history. But this book is no simple retelling of significant events or an examination of important political anthems, although, of course, she does this as well. Instead, she grounds her study in the media networks and material culture by which music circulated throughout Poland and internationally, from state-sanctioned art music festivals to clandestine recordings distributed via cassette tapes. She considers how different kinds of music contributed to the civil resilience of a country under martial law, while at the same time amplifying and narrating the Solidarity movement and its leaders. Hello, Andrea. It's great to have you on New Books in Music today.
Thank you so much for having me, Kristen.
So how did you come by this topic? As you note in your book, Poland is a pretty unusual country for European and North American musicologists to study. And in fact, there's not even that much about the history of Poland in English. So how did you come to this area to focus on as you worked on the larger topic of music and politics?
I really got interested in studying the cultural history of music in Polish lands through an interest actually in socialism, in music and socialism, in how artists, composers, politicians, organizers thought that a political ideology like socialism might affect or even inspire changes in musical life. So actually, when I was a student, one of the things I was doing is thinking about this more comparatively. I was interested in projects in the United States that were driven by passionate socialist commitments. I was interested in the way in which East German and West German history during the Cold War really diverged. And I was interested in thinking about how the different countries of what we tend to think of as East Central Europe, how they have different musical histories during the Cold War. This is kind of like almost a sort of scientific approach where I'm thinking like, oh, let's run these different case studies and compare them and see what factors produce what different outcomes. This is pretty naive and foolish of me. Maybe if I wanted to be kind to my past self, I might say ambitious. But it was as you say, like kind of a response to the way in which Western European narratives of music history dominate not just music historiography, but also how we think about Western music historiography generally. So we think about the United States as in the shadow of Western Europe, in the process sort of placing Eastern Europe on the periphery as well. And you can think about the ways in which like early recordings in the United States called ethnic recordings when they're by Lithuanian Americans and Polish Americans, and not necessarily the case in terms of French Americans and likewise. So I was wanting to kind of challenge that centripetal force of Western Europe and of English language circulations, of let's say even capitalist circulations, thinking about 20th century history. So I had this ambitious project where I was going to do all of these things and learn all of these languages. And I basically just stumbled in Poland because I, first of all, needed to learn a language, and I started there. And found myself in this world of archives, stories, sounds, musics that I just hadn't had a lot of exposure to, both in my education in the United States and also having studied in Berlin in Germany and outside of London in the United Kingdom after my undergraduate years. So I just felt like my naivete like came back to really... I just saw it and felt like there was a lot to learn and a lot of actually, you know, to use a kind of uncomfortable metaphor, like a lot of uncharted territory, a lot of room for scholarly play, stories that hadn't been told, so they didn't have dominant narratives, at least in music studies. Little did I know that the Polish 1980s and really Polish history during the Cold War in general built up of its own myths and its own hegemonic narratives, and that I would have to learn those in order to figure out where my research, where the stories that I heard from my research associates, how they would play out. So it's kind of coincidence. It's kind of because just from a historian's perspective, Poland has a very special history, as do, of course, most countries during the Cold War, in that music received a lot more wiggle room. That's the easiest way to understand it, than a lot of the other countries in which state socialist governments were being established. So the Communist Party sort of agreed with the Composers Union. This is a facile summary, but they agreed with the Polish Composers Union's argument that music didn't have as much political potential or political danger as the other arts. This is in contrast to kind of some of the post-Second World War narratives, both in the Soviet Union and in places like West Germany, where a reckoning with the Nazi Party's abuse of music had to happen, and which had very different results for musical styles that were supported by the state. So basically a lot of different kinds, different genres of music, including American ones, or nominally American ones like jazz, and ones that were associated with Central Europe, to which Poland belongs, like the musical avant-garde, these were supported by state institutions. So it meant that there was a lot, a kind of different history to uncover Poland as neither West nor East, as a story, a history that's not predictable. At least coming from my certainly biased American perspective, where I'd been fed the Cold War propaganda that everything east of Berlin was behind, backwards, deficient, abject, all of these kind of stories that Americans were told in popular culture, but also in official history books about global culture in the second half of the 20th century that puts Eastern Europe sort of behind the West and helps narrate story of American exceptionalism.
Well, before we get into that, actually, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk about, was sort of what you've done to push against that narrative. But maybe first, just to make sure we're all on the same page, could you give us the 2-minute version of the historical context of what was going on in Poland in the period that you are looking at, just to make sure we all know the same thing? Because as you say, we don't talk about Eastern Europe nearly as we should in American historiography, musical or otherwise. And so I'm sure there are some people that will sort of have vaguely heard of this, but don't know any details.
Yeah. So we tend to think of the 70s and 80s, 1970s and 80s, that is, as a kind of period of late socialism, where there were waves of economic revitalization in Eastern Europe, where a state-regulated economy started to enable certain aspects of capitalism. For example, there were record labels run by the state, but also department stores. There were where bands had to, or where you could sort of buy competing brands of clothing. There was a general sort of a sense of an everyday that that wasn't how would I describe this? I would say we tend to think when in the United States we think about life under communism in Eastern Europe, we think of rebuilding efforts in the 1950s, of gray days, of empty shelves. In the 1970s, that's no longer the case. There are cherished television programs. There's an investment in mass culture that's not just loaded with state propaganda, but with ideas about entertainment. There are crooning pop stars. There are rock bands where people have hair like the Beatles. There are students studying abroad in exchange programs, both with the Soviet Union and with Western European counterparts. So there's a kind of porosity to the Iron Curtain at this moment in history, as the Soviet Union is seeking out ways to continue to be a stable global superpower. And so in Warsaw, what you have is an increased, not in Warsaw, but rather in Poland, we can think about, like, I guess you told me 2 minutes. Basically, we can think of, this is precisely the environment that allows student movements to get off the ground, especially more mainstream ones that centralize and bring together divergent political opinions against the powers that be. So in this moment, you get increased student engagement, also increased energy from the Catholic Church. One of the most important events in Polish history during the 20th century was the nomination or the selection of Pope John Paul II, who was himself Polish, to lead the Catholic Church, which gave the nation a sense of incredible patriotic pride. It's a nation where 90% of the population identifies as Roman Catholic or identified as Roman Catholic during the Cold War. And so Polish Catholic identity and Polish identity are wound up together, if not in a spiritual way, then at least in a symbolic order for nationalism. So at the beginning of the decade, these student movements, the involvement of the clergy and the Catholic Church in negotiating change, political change, led to an environment filled with interpersonal networks, more creative freedom, a lot of international connections and networks that really paved the way for what would become a decade of incredible change, with highs and lows, where it wasn't always clear that state socialism would come to an end, but it was clear that state socialism was changing and the rules of the game were changing along the way. First with the legalization of the Solidarity Trade Union, but then as that union was pushed underground during martial law in December 1981, a sort of activated underground or unofficial is the term that's used in the Eastern European context, network of organizers who had decades of experience organizing, communicating, arguing with each other even, and who were invested in protecting, advocating for, and preserving Polish national identity or even national sovereignty or autonomy within a Cold War context in which the nation had been treated very much like a pawn. First, between in the 19th century, three empires, the Habsburg Empire, the Prussian Empire, and the Russian Empire, which had divided up Poland. And that sort of loss of independence in the 19th century is this kind of historical wound that was being renegotiated after First, the Nazi Germany's invasion of Poland and the subsequent Soviet one in 1939, and then the imposition of state socialism after the Second World War. So you have these sort of chains of historical traumas that are instigating, fueling, and shaping Polish nationalist movements. And that's the kind of backdrop for the granular analysis that I try to do of sonic environments, media networks and communication, but also the kind of atmosphere for art music composition, especially as a kind of affective or emotional catharsis in dealing with political, let's say, turmoil, unrest, but also just maybe instability and precarity. So that these are sort of affective atmospheres, zones that people find themselves in variously throughout the 1980s until this moment of euphoria that globally happens with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, but slowly happens with the negotiation of political change. Toward an end of state socialism in Poland, that sort of becomes the dominant lens through which we understand the 80s retrospectively, or remember the 80s retrospectively.
Well, that is very helpful. Thank you. I'm going to date myself, but I was in high school and college during the Solidarity years, and so I know my understanding of what was going on was really colored by the Cold War and by the discourse of the Cold War in the United States. And as you said, retrospectively, we see, oh, that was sort of the beginning of the end until you get to the fall of the Berlin Wall. But as you were saying earlier in your first answer, that has also really colored the way that that history has been told, at least sort of the first pass of that history was told. What do you think that you do in your book that maybe nuances or counters or challenges that sort of way of understanding the Solidarity movement, those years of the 80s in Poland?
In my book, what I try and do is understand the Solidarity movement as a story that we tell ourselves about how social movements work and how social movements come to have meaning, whether we're participating in the organizing, or as you kind of positioned yourself, observing the social movement and from afar and understanding it as a kind of symbol of the fact that the people broadly can change society. I think one of the things, like the anthem, the protest anthem itself, one of the reasons we love social movements is because they stand in for a notion that people can have a voice, and that voice is meaningful and has an effect. That, you know, if you sing together, quote unquote, in harmony, that represents a real way of working together, right? Working together in harmony, coordinating your efforts. And I think that what I do in the book is trace this idea. Like, what are the sort of like modes of understanding sound and music to do that work? So I start out the book just by kind of thinking about sound, thinking about how sound is necessary for the kind of communication and the network that social movements are built on. And then I ground that in specifically how the Solidarity movement used it, which was very much of its time, using pamphletry, using cassettes, using underground radio stations, using handwritten notes, sometimes using music as a code, right? A song that everyone knows what it's supposed to mean, but that meaning isn't said in the text, in the lyrics that are sung. And then I kind of move through different vectors of how sound and protest have meaning for us in the stories that we tell about social movements. So in answer to your question, I would say the chapter that really tries to get at this idea of, or sort of unravel the idea of solidarity as this moment of, you know, Western democracy defeating communism, is something like the chapter on silence that I have, which delves into the months immediately following martial law declaration in Poland. So starting mid-December, the cold of winter, martial laws declared, essentially squashing any legitimacy of the solidarity movement, imprisoning or at least detaining many of its members, including some instrumentalists who played in orchestras, some music journalists who worked for the radio, who had spoken about solidarity, and who basically the government took down not just the leaders of the opposition, but also some of the people who were sort of routinely involved in the mechanisms of distribution. And this time is really imagined, especially the first 3 months, as one in which the government became viciously threatening. It's remembered as this moment where a symbolic moment that tells us that we can't trust government, that totalitarian moves can be mobilized at any point in time, and that civil liberty is not something we can take for granted. But what I also, while I'm not undermining that, certainly not that memory or that emotional fear that this moment came to symbolize, what I do is spend time looking through, listening to diaries, recordings made, and stories told about life that continued during that time. So concerts that happened in homes, unofficial, underground, not supported through state networks. How did music and sound animate those spaces and become a way for people to combat, even heal some of the traumas that had been triggered by this declaration? But I also spend a lot of time looking at how rich intellectually the life that people held while in detention were, and how powerful music was as a way for people to communicate, first on a symbolic level. So one of the things that happened is people celebrated the Christmas holidays in prison, in detention, and Christmas carols were retexted to narrate responses to the government, to organize conversations about values among the opposition. I think also one of the things that I try to do is show the meeting places and the frictions among different components of the opposition. So to highlight that while the movement was underfoot, it was never clear and coherent or homogenous. So looking at the ways in which the socialist branches of the intelligentsia who were so committed had friction with some of the members of the clergy, the ways in which elements of misogyny or certain more right-wing brands of patriotism were really present in the movement. That comes out in the final chapter of my book, which is called Chorus, which shows the way that a chorus doesn't just bring together people in harmony, it also can bring together discordant voices. So I look at a very powerful song in Polish history. It translated into English as God Save Poland, but it's a 19th century hymn that has nationalist undertones, and its text has been changed so many times since the early 19th century. And it was retexted again and sung sort of spontaneously throughout many of the opposition's gatherings with different texts. But it's a hymn about the Virgin Mary, and it's really interesting to see the moments in which it's given a kind of abrasive or almost anti-Semitic language. It's also used and retexted by scouting troops to negotiate difference among those individuals. Basically, I want to show a kind of plurality of the social movement and show that through music you can see both some of the moments where people were really standing together and singing, and some of the moments in which there was friction and in which power had to be renegotiated.
One of the things that I found really interesting, actually, that picks up on what you were just saying is you do focus on a couple of songs that were really meaningful. One of them is God Save Poland. There's another, it's the Polish National Anthem. And I was really struck by how Polish nationalism and Polish national songs were so important, which I think of as being a little bit unusual in a political movement, because usually those are the kinds of, you know, those are so associated with the government. And so you push against those rather than incorporate them as part of political dissent. Can you talk a little bit about why that happened in the Solidarity movement, that this Polish nationalism was such an important aspect of it, as well as Polish national music?
That's an interesting perspective. I think that you've put your finger on one of the ways in which my book ends up telling a story that is certainly more mainstream or more top down of the opposition than one might. So there would certainly be ways to look at subcultures, especially there's a whole movement called independent culture that was really skeptical of national symbols, especially as kind of easy to imagine from a Western perspective, especially, you know, punk groups where student culture, but also kind of a rampant and unsystematic anarchy shaped as just kind of like an affective loudness, let's say. And I purposefully don't integrate those aspects, those subcultures, into my book, not because they aren't incredibly important in understanding the sort of rich variety of musics that different groups came to identify with their experience of the 1980s, but because there was never a strategic way that the opposition or the leaders were, you know, kind of a generation older of the opposition, they could never really respond to those popular musics. They turned more to the popular musics of, say, or the kinds of genres that had been important in Czechoslovakia in the 1960s, but also in France and in the United States in the early 1960s. So things like singer-songwriter music, as well as where you have this idea of like the individual expressing their subjectivity, but also an individual who's a storyteller. So I think one of the things that national music does for the Polish opposition is it tells a story of the Polish nation in which the fact that it is subjugated as a state within a Warsaw Pact doesn't make sense or needs to necessarily come to an end. So the national anthem is itself a song about working towards independence. It's not a song that was written in a moment of Polish independence. It's a sort of paradoxical refrain is talks about the fact that Poland is still alive as long as it has not perished. So it's a kind of pathetic in a sentimental sense of the word national anthem, in that it doesn't come at the moment of triumph, but in this kind of aspirational, or you know, what I describe as at some points in the book as also kind of, it's kind of like the upbeat to the moment of political reckoning. So singing that song allows people to draw a connection between themselves as Polish citizens and the very alive and cultural memory moment of that partition of Poland in the 19th century that I mentioned. Other national symbols were important because of the traumatic losses of World War II on Polish lands. It's what historians of Eastern Europe have maybe focused on in their histories of mid 20th century Poland, is the way in which wartime trauma was told or remembered as, you know, put in the container of a national trauma in order to kind of obscure or maybe even hide some of the ways in which wartime experiences weren't the same, right? So an assimilated Jewish family that was in hiding during the war, oftentimes did not narrate that story, but instead narrated themselves as Polish in the post-war period and clung to some of the same songs and symbols that were so important for the opposition. I think another component of the way that sort of national music plays out here is actually a pride in a lot of the musical material that was produced in Poland in the 19th and 20th century, beginning with the heroic composer who's celebrated both as kind of popular music entertainer, as a performer, Chopin, but also as, of course, artistic genius and inspired poet, whose music has been woven into Polish national identity since the 19th century, but particularly anew in the post-war period in the 1940s and 50s. Celebrating Chopin was always an important part of the soft diplomacy that the Polish, the People's Republic of Poland, so that's the state socialist government, did. People were also very proud of Polish musical avant-garde, just as they were proud of the Polish film, especially cinematography, in the communist period, because it had achieved global success. So composers like Krzysztof Penderecki, who just recently passed away at the beginning of the first half of 2020, and Witold Lutosławski, who wrote symphonic works, and Henryk Mikołaj Górecki wrote symphonic works that were played by the world's top orchestras and beloved by Western audiences. Górecki's Third Symphony is one of the top-selling commercial recordings of classical music in the 20th century. So there's a way in which these musical celebrities are really important because they put Poland on the map. And so one of the things that I wrestle with is the way that both some of the people I spoke with in Poland are eager to understand the relationship between these notable and known notorious musicians and the opposition. So they want to know what their musical heroes are thinking politically. But I'm also interested in how, you know, music critics in the United States and in the UK and in Germany tell stories about Polish protest by writing about the music that they know. And interestingly, they don't care to engage with Polish popular musics. Probably there's a kind of facile explanation for that, which is a language barrier. I think within Poland, especially among the intelligentsia, so in urban contexts, at universities, student culture, but also within the artists' organizations that I'm talking about, there's just an incredible division between composed art music and other musics. There's an incredible hierarchy that really, at a certain point, considers things like symphonies music, but songs, especially sung poetry, not music. That is considered kind of, first and foremost, poetic, literary form of expression. And one of the things that's probably not clear to US audiences, maybe less sensical, is that it was actually poets and writers who were under some of the most scrutiny from this Polish state, which meant that there was kind of a disconnect between the social communities of the literary scene and the music scene, even though they were, of course, friends and artistic collaborators. But in terms of political collaborations, more figures in the literary world were under scrutiny, and then as a result, kind of went out on a limb and participated in the solidarity movement than musicians, who tended to stand back, especially those sort of global success stories who I mentioned. There were, of course, many students, many more experimental composers, also composers abroad, who who used their musical compositions to try and, as members of the diaspora, you know, take a emotionally work through a relationship to their homeland by writing about solidarity or writing about some of the events of solidarity. Yeah, but it's an interesting question to think about it in terms of like, what is national music? You know, I write at one point about a symphony called the Polish Symphony, which incorporates some of these hymns from the Catholic Church, specifically Polish hymns, Polish resistance songs from World War II, these kinds of things. You know, that kind of composition seems very, very much of its moment, very much trying to communicate to an audience that has these older protest songs from the 19th century ringing in their ears, rather than an audience that's looking for new ways of configuring a kind of society or a social enactment of a future in musical genres, such that we see in something like punk or some of the other musical genres that in the UK were associated with political movements for political change in the 1980s.
The other thing that struck me, not only about how nationalism was so important, was also how important historical commemoration of one kind or another was to the action of protest. So you talk about how a lot of protest marches were not a march, but sort of a gathering of people was really a small gathering of people who are commemorating some aspect of Polish history. Or several really important events were around the mass commemoration masses for people who had died, or had been murdered by the state. So strikers who were killed in 1970 by police, or Jerzy Papawuszko, who was a priest who was murdered by this the security services. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of, I don't know if it's commemoration of history or if it's commemoration of trauma that is important to not only the movement as a protest movement, but also the musical expression because of that?
Yeah, I think that we tend to, as this kind of getting back to like, why do we tell stories about music and protest? Why is it so important to affirm for ourselves, either as people living in the 21st century in a time of global instability and national precarity, a time when inequalities are more visible than ever? We find ourselves talking more and more about music and forward momentum, right? So when we look at histories, scholars have tended to focus on the moments that give people hope. One of the things I found just coming in as an outsider to this story is that when I one of the things I did as part of my research was actually just talk to people, members of, you know, congregations, religious congregations, whether, you know, the Reform Jewish community in Warsaw, but also many Catholic parishes, is just talk with elder generations about their experiences of that time. And the moments of hope were not the moments that had the most kind of weight in their memories of this time. Now, of course, that's in part a product of when I was doing my research in 2009, 2010, 2011, while I was living in Warsaw, there was a plane crash in which over 90 governmental dignitaries and cultural figures were perished instantly when the plane crashed in Smolensk in Ukraine. And this was experienced again as a trauma, one that casts the Polish nation and especially sort of like its capacity to transform itself into an autonomous and confident and powerful European nation, member of the European Union, put that into question. And so emotions were running high, but also kind of worry was there. And so a lot of the stories that people would tell me began, people didn't want to talk about strikes. They didn't want to talk about, their sort of the moments of happiness. When I just sat with them, they wanted to talk about these moments of solace, moments that still gave them solace. And so some of them are more public moments, like the ones you're talking about, because as I've kind of intimated, a lot of my book is about shared moments of musical work, not necessarily private ones. I'm not looking at subcultures. I'm not looking at subversive scenes. I'm looking at kind of like a sort of flavor of the moment. But some people would talk about how they saved one cassette that circulated among the opposition, and it wasn't something that had, like an important political essay read aloud on it. It wasn't something that had even their favorite album by one of the singer-songwriters who played with guitar. The most notable one, or one of the most cherished ones, is someone named Jacek Kaczmarski, but there were others as well. But they would talk about how they saved a cassette that was filled with lullabies because they remembered singing lullabies to their child, to their then infant child, to that cassette. And I think these moments of commemoration often are not the bombastic moments of commemoration or national coherence that you might have, but actually ones in which, like you're suggesting, trauma is being experienced, but also history is being retold. Those were very important, and they've become more important in the three decades since 1989, and at the time when I was doing research, it had been just two decades. So I think that's one other reason people were really interested in talking about them. So the death of Father Jerzy Popiełuszko, which was at the hands of two agents of the Polish secret police, was an incredibly important moment a shared moment of national loss. One thinks of other times in American history when the assassination, which is what Popiełuszko's death was experienced as, of a leader, really felt as though it was an attack on the entirety of a social movement. Popiełuszko had been important actually not precisely because he wasn't a major figure in the Polish Catholic Church. He was a priest who was a kind of everyman. He had rural upbringing, which allowed non-urban Catholics to relate to him. He traveled around the country in a car after the formation of the Solidarity Union, holding sermons to workers on strike, to offering solidarity in the form of worship. And so in a way, he was repeating, Catholic liturgy is built on all kinds of structures of ritual repetition. And his work was a part of that, a kind of continuation of the normal, of what's needed for human survival among faith communities. And he was a rather young person. And so he symbolized for many people, a kind of access to political work that was in the mundane care that humans can offer each other. One of the music critics who was really involved with some of the organizing work around Popiełuszko's parish in Warsaw was someone who got involved because he was interested in donating clothes to detained prisoners, but also food to families that have been left behind when organizers were arrested. So, it's not sort of heroic political work that comes in the dreaming up of ideas for political change, but it's a mutual aid network driven by the Catholic Church. And people felt a kind of, there was a kind of humility to his person that was captured most in his voice, which was kind of unremarkable. He was bad at singing. The chant of Catholic services is not designed or not even theologically sort of interpreted as something where beauty or aesthetic evaluation is at stake. But it became an access to both God and Popiełuszko's model of personhood. So when he was assassinated by members of the Secret Service, and he disappeared for a while and his fate was unknown, it kind of gashed open this huge wound that people experienced as their own. But that also meant it kind of called into question, like, what are the sort of bare acts of humanity that can, why are those subject to violence? He was seen as a kind of nonpartisan activist, if you will. And I think when people were writing pieces about him, singing songs in commemoration of him, his reenacting his masses that he held, holding vigil rather, to mark the month since his loss, I think they were striving to work toward a kind of normalcy and to keep the community that his work had helped form alive. And so in a way, it's sort of hard to say, oh, like this can be captured in, you know, in something like a, it kind of can't be reproduced. It's so contextually specific. And I think that that's one of the reasons that it offered sort of care to people at the time, and it's through that embodied experience, which kind of continues. There are still masses held in his honor, mostly older individuals who would have been at least alive during the time of his original or of his work. They continue into the present. They're pushed and pulled in all sorts of new political directions, but they continued the memories of those, the memories of his voice, even listening to his voice again, or imagining his voice to be comforting still. These are all ways of in which political work can extend care. That is something like, you know, the work of mourning, as you mentioned, in terms of offering people sort of catharsis and calm, rather than, yeah, moments of defiance and strength. Right, so there's a kind of way in which what I found in noting the power of commemoration is not just the moments of sort of like national pride, but moments in which national vulnerability was communicated, rearticulated, even sensationalized, I will say, used not always toward inclusive ends, because of course an emphasis on the Catholic Church is not something that can necessarily, but invite anyone to feel represented and heard and cared for.
One other aspect of it that I wanted to bring out, and since we're getting close towards the end of our time together, I'll make this my last question. But I was struck by how some of the music you were talking about and some of the ways of demonstrating was just really sarcastic. There's a lot of sort of, maybe it's cynicism or political satire going on, to the point where it felt sort of almost punkish to me. It reminded me maybe of Pussy Riot a little bit, which is of course the, I don't know if you call it a music group or a political collective of women in Russia that have engaged in political work. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that aspect of it. That is not the sort of trauma or commemoration aspect. It's not the national aspect, but another way of communicating their ideas.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question to kind of close out on, because I think you put your finger on, you know, if I'm kind of letting Popiełuszko tell this story of like intimate moments in the opposition, moments where calm reflection did important work to help people feel a sense of belonging or maybe feel a sense of solace. I think that there are other ways in which intimacy is enacted in playful and joyful moments. And I think it does have a lot to do with the with a culture of irony that comes really, I experienced coming from the literary scenes in Polish culture. So I mean, you asked about Pussy Riot, who's, you know, using kind of one of their most, they are both, you know, a sort of musical group, a political group, but I think I think about them as performance artists who identify strongly with visual culture, where you use some of the ideas from pop art, where you take a recognizable symbol and kind of push it to its maximum in order to subvert it. And I think you do see people doing that is, you know, they'll sort of say willfully untrue things they don't believe, with the idea that you know that they don't mean it. And there's also all kinds of ways in which sarcasm and irony have just been a part of literary writing, humor in Polish modernism, the discourses of Polish modernism, ranging from something that's obviously musical, like cabaret. And there are a number of cabaret songs that become like viscerally important for the movement, not necessarily because they themselves have anything smart or original to critique about the party, but because the function of irony and cynicism, as you point out, in cabaret makes some of those critiques less, it sort of creates an environment in which those critiques naturally move around the ecology. I think also it's a way where people, language play is a way in which people are using music to do what a sociologist who studied this decade called the use of the symbols of power. Wait, now I'm misquoting it. The power of symbols and the symbols of power. So taking something like this is one of the sort of clever moves of the solidarity movement itself, is taking an idea that's central to Marxism, solidarity, and using it to undo state socialism, which of course is, you know, this is just one iteration of socialism as enacted in a modern nation state, but the idea is still there that, you know, you're kind of undoing the master's, you're using the master's tools to break the mask down the master's house. But I think that, I think there's a kind of jubilant, there's a kind of ephemeral aspect to a lot of these moments of irony that allow some of this polysemic work to happen. So the fact that you can interpret things differently. There are several songs where one artist calls out another artist in the way that we saw in this summer's musical releases in response to, or as a part of, and in response to Black Lives Matter, artists sort of evaluating each other's political activism and you know, throwing shade at each other. And that's really going on as well. And it's a part of what gives certain discourses energy. I think that there is a willingness among many of the organizers, especially younger ones who are subjects in my book, there's a willingness to fight and be wrong. There's a willingness to be cantankerous just to cause a scene. And there are musical genres where that really, that kind of provocative aesthetic really works. You know, punk is one. So they're, you know, they're sort of symbols that people play with. There's this incredible ludic quality to some rock anthems where they're playing with the fact that the Polish premier, who was an army general, he always wore sunglasses, right? And he had this kind of, you know, a face that people like to make fun of with like sort of big jowls. And you know, a character like that appears in a lot of rock anthems at the time, right? And so it sort of makes space for laughter. We tend to think of, I think at the end of the day, I do believe that music is really important for political change. I just don't think that, I think there's so much more to it than whether it is part of what can be instrumentalized for political effect. So I think when we tend to want to know whether or not something actually got the job done, and I don't know that that's the most interesting thing to talk about when we talk about what music does. I think it interacts with with social movements in so many different ways. It supports them, it's a foundation of them, it becomes a kind of Achilles heel when you have some of these nationalist symbols obscuring difference, right? Allowing people to imagine that there aren't hierarchies and that there are, you know, that it's an inclusive movement. At the end of the day, Polish nationalism, of course, paves the way for discourses of a nation where Catholicism is the dominant political ideology. So it changes the relationship. It's paved a way for a post-socialist Poland in which Solidarity Movement, that is, has paved a way for a post-socialist Poland where many communities are minoritized and there isn't an infrastructure to handle those differences. And many of those seeds were sown by some of the figures in this book who at the time saw themselves as politically left and have moved further and further toward the right. So I think, irony is one of those places where we are challenged as researchers to stop thinking about whether or not we need protest anthems. What it shows is that we need music in many, many different ways, and that political change is not necessarily the result of singing, right? But that singing cannot be sort of extricated from its political context.
Yes, I completely agree with you. I get very impatient with the question of whether, you know, music works as a form of political action. I think that's not a very interesting question. You know, there's so many more interesting things to think about, and as your book does. So I think that is a great way to sort of sum up this very interesting book you've written, and I really appreciate you being here to talk about it. Certainly, it was a huge project for you. You noted that you were doing a lot of your ethnography and interviewing a decade ago. So now that this book is out, what is next on your agenda?
So as you've suggested, and I'm so thankful for the care with which you read this, and I have to say, I think you brought it's a delight to talk about this book at a distance from the political moment in which it happened, but also, you know, since it has come out, but it's also really challenging and interesting to talk about it in the current political climate after, you know, sort of uproarious 2020 from the music and politics perspective in North America, among many places. But, you know, one of the things you pointed out right from the beginning is that sort of I became fascinated with media ecology and media networks. You know, I'm as interested in writing about, you know, people in Jordan Hall in Boston listening to some of this music, members of the Polish American community standing up and choreographing and claiming to weep while they listen to some of the movement music of Solidarity, as I am in, you know, a British artist who makes mostly electronic music, who composed his own track in response to Popiełuszko's death. And so one of the things that I just really, as a researcher, got interested in was how peculiar this history is because of the presence of bountiful archives of magnetic tape, cassette tapes deposited actually in the Solidarity Trade Union's archive itself, cassette archives curated by activists abroad, especially in emigre communities, people who'd been politically persecuted and had left Poland. But also domestic archives, private archives, people sharing with me, like I mentioned, you know, mixtapes of lullabies, reel to reels that have been copied among the opposition itself to keep their own grassroots archive. And so what I'm doing now is kind of following my nose into thinking about what kind of archive magnetic tape is. Not really. I mean, I kind of consider this book a treatment of like magnetic tape as an archive for a social movement, but I'm thinking in broader history and thinking about the history of the portability of tape and thinking about music circulation and tape recording. Specifically, I'm researching how it came to be that something like the discipline of ethnomusicology uses tape to do field recording. What is the history of field recording and how is it related to the history of tape recording? I'm interested here not just in institutional disciplines like ethnomusicology, but also something like oral history that uses tape all the time. I'm also interested in amateur, and this builds up kind of directly out of my social movement interest, in what kind of amateur tape archives there are and what that reveals about how we imagine listening itself to be something that connects us to place. So I've been diving into a couple of particularly rich and compelling case studies that get me in and outside of the Polish context. So thinking again about centripetal forces in music history and how we can kind of avoid getting pulled in by them. But I'm just enjoying and being challenged by, listening as an archival method and how many more questions it offers than answers.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And I'm sorry we didn't get to talk a little bit more about, you know, that idea of media network and cassette tapes, because that was very interesting, the way that this music was circulated through cassette tapes. So I'm glad to hear that you are going to continue thinking about that, because that was definitely fascinating. So thank you so much for joining me today. My name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music. And I've been discussing Musical Solidarities, Political Action, and Music in Late 20th Century Poland with the book's author, Andrea Bowman. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Kristen. It was wonderful to talk with you.